Since the 16th century, we have been fascinated by Henry VIII and the man who stood beside him, guiding him, enriching him, and enduring the king's insatiable appetites and violent outbursts until Henry ordered his beheading in July 1540. After a decade of sleuthing in the royal archives, Professor Dermot McCulloch has emerged with Thomas Cromwell, A Revolutionary Life, a new understanding of Henry's mercurial chief minister. History has not been kind to the son of a Putney brewer who became the architect of England's split with Rome. However, McCulloch unveils a more sympathetic figure. Was Cromwell the villain of history or the victim of its creation? The new book again is Thomas Cromwell, A Revolutionary Life, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dermot McCulloch to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
A pleasure.
The book is fascinating and so rich in its telling of this man's story. Let us begin with what brought you to it, of what you wanted and what ultimately you thought was missing in our understanding of Thomas Cromwell.
Well, Joe, I mean, I've lived with Thomas Cromwell, in a sense, all through my university career. I, of course, studied history as a student and went on to do a doctorate, which was on Tudor England, 16th century England. And if you do that, you meet Thomas Cromwell very quickly. A huge batch of his papers survive in the Royal Archives, which were confiscated when he was arrested. And so I've been looking at Cromwell's papers for 40 years. And it was having written a lot on Tudor England, including a biography of his great friend and contemporary, Thomas Cranmer, the Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury, that I decided that the last book in this big sequence would be Thomas Cromwell. So I went back to the archives and I spent, as you say, near a best part of a decade looking through them. And you look at him because he is so central to everything. He wasn't chief minister for all that long. It's 9 years, really, before the king executed his best minister. But things changed during that time. And you look at England in 1500, and you look at England in 1600, and it's a different place. And the hinge of that difference is the 1530s, the decade in which Thomas Cromwell was chief minister.
As you say, you have lived with this man for almost all of your university life. So how much did your opinion, and I'll use that word loosely, your thoughts on him and his place change, especially with these materials from the British National Archives and the British Library?
Right from the start, I saw that there are two narratives about Thomas Cromwell. He's either a hero or he's a villain. And he was a hero early on to Protestants as they formed the Reformation. And I realized that that's not how people are normally. They're not usually totally dreadful or totally great. And so I approached the subject looking for the man who was a real rounded human being, not just a cardboard cutout caricature. And you can do that with the archives because of the thousands of pieces of paper and parchment relating to him. And you get the picture in the end of, in my opinion, an interesting, very talented, often quite brutal man, but a man capable of great passion, a great friendship, adored his only son, Gregory. So all that is a complicated picture. And I think it's also a picture which changed during the course of those nine tumultuous years under the king. Because if there's anyone who I ended up disliking, having made his acquaintance in depth, it was Henry VIII. Mm. He is such an egotistical, conceited monster. And clearly lots of charm, lots of talent. And yet it's all about me with Henry VIII. And he had that capacity which that sort of great leader has of making good people do bad things. And I think that's what happened to Thomas Cromwell. He was drawn into the king's frequently murderous political designs and his destruction of quite admirable people. And you can't let Cromwell off the hook for that. He was part of that.
Mm. You mentioned your previous work, Thomas Cranmer, A Life, and When it comes to looking at his life and doing what you did for that biography, was it a case in with the life of Thomas Cromwell where you are taking the information and integrating the lives of these two men to get a sense of what was happening?
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, the notes I was using 25 years ago to write the Cranmer book were still very relevant to the Cromwell book. But what was fascinating in taking the two lives side by side was how the picture changed once you were looking at it through Cromwell's eyes rather than Cranmer's eyes. They were great friends. But what I hadn't appreciated was that there was a problem in the friendship in the shape of someone else, and that was Anne Boleyn, the woman who became Henry VIII's second queen, great love of his life. Now, I'd thought of these three, as so many historians have over the years, as a sort of heroic trio of Protestants, or a villainous trio of Protestants, if that's how you look at it. They're all pushing for the Reformation. But what became apparent to me was that Anne was a problem in this relationship. Actually, Thomas Cromwell and Anne loathed each other, whereas Archbishop Cranmer was really her creation. I mean, he was a chaplain to the Boleyn family, and she really brought him into the king's circle. And so now it complicated things. There was Cranmer and Anne being very closely related, Cromwell and Anne hating each other. I had to think out how Cranmer and Cromwell now related. And I think it was difficult. I think they came together because they did share a view of the Reformation. But I think all the years that Queen Anne was queen, early 1530s, there was a problem. And what also fascinated me was looking at what happened when Anne was executed, which was really, I think, the work of Thomas Cromwell. Cranmer was sort of punished for that because some of his richest estates were taken away from him by the king, and also by Act of Parliament, and given to Cromwell. It's as if it's saying, look, you were too loyal to Anne, and Cranmer was very bravely loyal to Anne right to the last, and now you're going to have to pay a penalty. But I think after that, Cranmer and Cromwell's relationship became much simpler because they're both pushing in the same direction, which is to create a Protestant church inside King Henry VIII's Reformation.
Dermot McCulloch is our guest. The name of the new book is Thomas Cromwell, A Revolutionary Life. You write about his childhood and about his upbringing, and Putney was where he was from, as I mentioned in the introduction. You write early on in the book, in this story, Putney is nothing and everything. Cromwell's smartest move was to flee it while still in his teens, to travel through mainland Europe and thus refashion himself as much more than a Tudor Englishman. Yet once he could enjoy the reward for his travels and administrative drudgery, he triumphantly reasserted his link to that ferryside village on the Thames. In summer 1536, he vaulted up the social scale in a move whose chutzpah did much to destabilize politics and sparked a great upheaval of rebellion in northern parts of the realm. That is an amazing accomplishment in a very short period of time.
Isn't it? Yeah, the boy from Putney. Putney's nowhere, you know. It's a village on the River Thames, upstream from London. And it's as if it were a service station on a freeway now. It's a sort of place that you'd drop off your barge and have a glass of ale, a tankard of ale, on your way up to a royal palace further up. And maybe the young Thomas Cromwell served a tankard of ale to some great man. That's the nearest he'd get. And then by the end of his career, as you've said in that long quotation, he was a nobleman with a title. And his title's very interesting because it's Lord Cromwell of Wimbledon. And your listeners probably won't appreciate that Wimbledon is the big manor, the area, the lordship in which the village of Putney sat. So what he was doing by becoming Lord Cromwell of Wimbledon was saying, I'm from Putney, and I don't care, all you members of the nobility, all you other lords, I'm going to just thrust that in your face. And that's sort of one of the things I liked about him. And that's why I use the word chutzpah. I think there's real sense of style about doing something like that. I'm not ashamed of my origins.
Talk a little bit about the relationship between Cromwell and Henry VIII. You didn't mention this at the beginning of our conversation, but in the meeting and the evil that they accomplished together, and how ultimately Cromwell rectified that, or at least put that in his mind that allowed him to do that.
Cromwell was always the fixer. You couldn't call him the king's friend. The king used people and valued them as long as they remained useful and did the work for him. And I do get a sense of Cromwell having an acute sense of the king's psychology and being able to manipulate him a bit. It's clear that they had rows. They're both men of fierce temper, and they were both capable of losing their temper. And so there were shouting matches that everyone could hear around the court. And the end of those shouting matches would be that the king would slap Cromwell across the cheek. And Cromwell would come out of the room where this had happened, sort of rubbing his cheek and with a sort of lopsided grin, because the king had to win in these particular rows, had to win, because he's king. But once he'd won, Cromwell knew that the next day he could probably get the result he wanted. I mean, one of his servants called it tempering the king, manipulating the king, if you like. There was subtlety about it, and it would normally work. And yet, in the end, you couldn't go on doing that with a man with such appetites as Henry VIII, such a determination always to win. It was a dangerous game to play, and there were so many enemies all the time, ready to feed poison into the king's ear, and Cromwell would know that.
One of the things that is so interesting, and you've written a 700-plus page book on this man's life, and really, the basics here, the main story, takes place over a 4-year period of time. That is remarkable to have that much turmoil in any life, much less his, in just 4 years.
Yes, and I felt his exhaustion. You know, I spent many days, I would start with his archive at 8:30 in the morning, and I'd finish at 7, with a few breaks, I must say. And, you know, I'd be exhausted because I could feel the tension of all that business going through. And as you say, the last 4 years are really manic, as he was trying to keep up with his success. His career had reached its height, and yet he knew all around him that the very success was the thing which so many of the natural governing class of England hated. And so one false move, and he was done for. And, of course, that's how it ended. Once he'd made false move with the king, the nobility could pounce, and that's what did for him.
So let's talk about that, the pouncing, if you will. The downfall began when?
In a sense, at the end of 1539. He was executed in July 1540. So about 8-9 months, and it looked as if it would be his biggest success, because it all centered around Henry VIII's fourth marriage of the six, and this was to a foreign princess, Anne of Cleves. And this would solve all sorts of problems for Cromwell. It was a good diplomatic marriage. It got him close to Protestants in mainland Europe. But also, the great thing about Anne was that she wasn't the daughter of an English nobleman. So she ticked all his boxes. Trouble was, when she turned up in England, the king just couldn't bear the sight of her. And this is really mysterious. No one has really fathomed Henry VIII's taste in women. But for whatever reason, he loathed her, but he couldn't get out of the marriage. There's no way out. And the only way out was actually to get married and then say that he couldn't perform sexually with her, and that would be a reason for annulling the marriage. And that's just terribly embarrassing. Can you imagine a magnificent king like Henry VIII having to admit to a row of clergy that he couldn't actually perform with his wife? And the man who got the anger was Cromwell, because he'd organized it. And that's the moment when the king would start listening to that steady stream of poison, which had always been there. But up till then, he had no reason to listen to it. That's the psychology of Henry VIII.
When in your telling, and it seems like there is a moment when Cromwell realizes that the tide has turned.
Yes, we get that from one of his servants who spoke to him in extreme confidence about it, and Cromwell was desperate. He knew that he was now facing the king's anger, and he could only just repeat again and again, it was a great matter, it was a great matter. And the servant knew his master was staring into the abyss, and in fact the servant started betraying him at that point and left for the opposition. And that's really perhaps a week before Thomas Cromwell was arrested when he was going to the king's royal council meeting, arrested by his fellow councillors, whipped off to the Tower of London before he could see the king, and that was it. He was in a cell until he was brought out to be executed. It was really important that he didn't see the king, because, again, the psychology of Henry VIII, if you looked him in the eye and said, you can't really execute me, can you? He would generally give way. There's a sort of weakness in this magnificent figure. And Cromwell was never given the chance to do that. It was very important not to let him see the king. And so he died.
Dermot McCulloch is professor of the history of the church at Oxford University and author of the new book, Thomas Cromwell, A Revolutionary Life. As we wrap up, talk a little bit, because you make the point in the book that some of the biggest risks this man took were ultimately to secure the future of his son Gregory.
Yes, and the biggest risk and the biggest opportunity was to marry young Gregory to King Henry VIII's sister-in-law, Elizabeth Seymour, who was Jane Seymour's sister. And that happened in 1537. And huge opportunity. And can you imagine the son of a brewer marrying the sister-in-law of a king? And can you imagine the feelings of the nobility, the aristocracy of England? So that was the biggest gamble. And what a gamble it was. Great marriage. It got him closer to the royal family than anyone else. And yet, it cemented so many people's hatred of him, the monumental snob, the Duke of Norfolk, who regarded himself as England's premier peer, in formal terms, was. He loathed that, although he had to conceal his hatred and fury. So Gregory is at the centre, and what Thomas Cromwell was doing was what every Tudor father wanted. He wanted to found a dynasty, just like the king, to keep his line going. And so Gregory, this rather adventurous, perhaps not terribly bright boy, had all Thomas Cromwell's hopes on him, and he took terrible risks. The marriage, pushing young Gregory forward, which would anger many gentry and nobility. So the story is one of a man passionate about his family. And interestingly, that Elizabeth Seymour actually did preserve Gregory, her husband, through Thomas Cromwell's fall, and got him a peerage, a barony out of the king. And there were Lords Cromwell down to the 17th century. So in that sort of curious way, Thomas Cromwell did get his ambition. He did found a noble dynasty.
He is beheaded, and as you indicate in the book, well, first of all, he's laid to rest not that far from the woman whose destruction he had choreographed, as you write,
yeah.
Anne Boleyn. And then,
same chapel.
And then he, Henry VIII, the killing goes on. You describe it as a slaughter.
Yeah. Because there were so many people Henry wanted to kill, and some of them were Protestants and some of them were Catholics. And there was a famous occasion just after Thomas Cromwell died of three Catholics being hanged, drawn, and quartered, and three Protestants being burned at the stake on the same day. It was a sort of murderous, even quality about it. And I think Henry did kill more people as he went along, and it may be that he deteriorated, his health got very bad. But I just think it's also the awful logic of his paranoia about his dynasty and the fact that he'd alienated himself from the old church and not quite reconciled himself to the new church. So there were lots of people he didn't approve of And not being approved of by Henry VIII often meant dying.
Dermot McCulloch, thank you very much for being with us.
A pleasure.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Thank you. Dermot McCulloch's new book is Thomas Cromwell, A Revolutionary Life. It is published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.